One of the downsides to living by myself and not having it in my family immediately close by is that I sometimes forget about holidays. So this is a bit of an intense sermon for Mother's Day, but I believe the Lord has a message for us in this text and that there are things for us to glean from it. Let us begin with a prayer. Gracious God, you who see us and know us in our most quiet moments, in our loudest fears, we thank you that you receive us and that you love us. We thank you for your presence among us. Make us like you. In the name of Jesus. Amen. We are returning this week to the story of David. And last week, he was our unexpected king. And he is not in place yet as king when we reach this story in the text. We're going to talk about revenge, about vengeance, and the scriptural and less scriptural ideas that we have about those. And in terms of David's overall story, we've gone about 10 chapters forward now. It's been many years. David is a grown man, and he has political and social power and a little bit of military might. And we see David and his men, those who are loyal to him, who are protecting him from Saul's wrath, in the area of Carmel. Carmel is further south than where David's family is from, but in the same general region. And David and his men find themselves in the wilderness, as is not unusual, and they work to keep that area safe. They're trying to stay out of vision of the king unnecessarily, but also protecting and supporting their community. One of the groups that they're helping to support in Carmel is a group of shepherds who have a very large flock that they're tending to, actually about 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats, all of these belonging to one man. And the shepherds that are caring for these animals would have to be in the wilderness because of space concerns, right? But Carmel also has the only water source, freshwater spring in that area. So they had to stay close, but not too close. But these shepherds are not warriors, though they may be in the wilderness. And they were not able to fully keep out the threats of the wilds of Judea. And so David and his men, since they were already around, would help keep them safe, make sure that there was nothing harming them from the outside, animals, things like that. But they also didn't take advantage. They didn't steal from the men. They didn't hurt them. They didn't try to swap things out or make unfair promises while they weren't paying attention. But the feast day had come, and Israel has several feast days in their calendar. And David sends 10 of his men as a message to the man who owns all of these animals. Now, feast days are not just days for eating food, though they do quite a lot of that, but they're also a day for making offerings to God. And so this kind of a large community would need to make a significant offering portion to the Lord. And so this message to this man, Nabal, by the way, is very simply this. We did this for you, protected your flocks as a free service. Would you be willing to make a contribution to our feast day, right? Okay, this is a high cost for them, but it's a happy day. And so they're hoping that even though Nabal had not asked for them to do this, that he would be generous with what he has. Nabal had also not set up anyone to protect the men. He had been neglectful in his duty as the head of these flocks. And so they're hoping that he will appreciate their hard work and offer a donation. So the 10 young men come to Nabal. And firstly, he makes them wait for his response. The text tells us specifically that they have to wait for him. And then when he does start to talk, it becomes clear that they would have rather he keep his mouth shut. Nabal is not rich for no reason. And his greedy, self-focused mindset becomes very obvious the second he opens his mouth. He starts off, "Who is David, son of Jesse?" And he goes on to say, "Plenty of people these days are actually just runaway slaves who hate their masters and are lazy and ne'er-do-wells. How can I know that that's not all of you? Are you asking me to share with you the meat I butchered for my men? The water drawn out of my well? Bread baked in my ovens?" He says, I have no idea who you are or where you come from, and you're not getting a single penny from me. Okay, this is deeply insulting on Nabal's part. First, his dismissal of David is really just petty. David is not a nobody. He's married into the household of the king. His family is from this area. His story is well known. You can't wander about with 600 men in the desert and be completely unknown to your community. For Nabal to dismiss him was ignorant at best and blatant disrespect at worst. Secondly, was the self-focused way that he brings up the work that they did and the identity of these men. He insinuates that they're just runaway slaves. So he then is reminding them of his position and one of influence, as well as their lack of importance. He demeans their work as much as their identity. In general, in this story, David is seen as a really humble man. Doesn't really get caught up in his ego. But there are always limitations, and apparently, this message from Nabal is going to be the breaking point. Because it would be one thing, you know, if David was the only one whose name is being drugged through the mud. That's going to happen when you're in power. But for his men to not be able to celebrate their feast day because of the greed of one man, to have unpaid wages because of one wealthy CEO, that's not going to fly for David, and he's going to do something about it. They had come in humility and respect to Nabal, who rejected their request, and now David is enraged. So the messengers come back to David with Nabal's answer, and David immediately says to his men, strap on your swords. 400 of their 600 group leave their camp to go and make an example of the house of Nabal. David in this story, you can see his fragility, his own ease to anger, but also his compassion, his love for his men, his loyalty. He's a complicated character in the best of times, but in this story you can tell that he believes in the rightness of his cause, his right to make right this unjust situation. He begins to seek out revenge. No greedy nepotism baby like Nabal was going to get away with kind of treating his men in this way. So maybe you found yourself in a similar situation, maybe a little less dramatic than the one David finds. And someone, it doesn't really matter who it was, dishonored you or those who matter to you. They insult your friend. They critique your loved one. They shame your family. They fail to appreciate your work. Maybe it's at work where someone takes credit for your efforts and gets a reward and you don't. Maybe it's a family situation where your efforts for love and affection are mocked. In that moment, all you think about is getting justice. You can feel the blood singing in your veins, revenge. Vengeance, retribution. You know that you're right, that your cause is right, your reasoning is right, so you begin to plot. You may not have a team of trained men at your side, but you couldn't care less because you're going to make it right. Someone has to pay for what was done. So we're going to read the response in this story from Nabal's wife, who's informed of what has happened by one of their servants. Her name is Abigail. And she has sent ahead of her a delegation with gifts and food and has prepared this feast for David and his men. So we're going to read from 1 Samuel 25. We're going to start in verse 23 and go through 34, New Revised Standard today. When Abigail saw David, she hurried and dismounted from the donkey and fell before David on her face, bowing to the ground. She fell at his feet and said, upon me, my Lord, be the guilt. Please let your servant speak in your ears and hear the words of your servant. My Lord, do not take seriously this ill-natured fellow, Nabal, for as his name is, so is he. Nabal is his name, and folly is with him. But I, your servant, did not see the young men of my Lord whom you sent. Now then, my Lord, as the Lord lives and as you yourself live, since the Lord has restrained you from blood guilt and from taking vengeance with your own hand, now let your enemies and those who seek to do evil to my Lord be like Nabal. And now let this present that your servant has brought to my Lord be given to the young men who follow my Lord. Please forgive the trespass of your servant. The Lord will certainly make my Lord a sure house because my Lord is fighting the battles of the Lord. And evil shall not be found in you so long as you live. If anyone should rise up to pursue you, to seek your life, the life of my Lord shall be bound in the bundle of the living under the care of the Lord your God. For the lives of your enemies he shall sling out as from the hollow of a sling. When the Lord has done to my Lord according to all the good that he has spoken concerning you and has appointed you prince over Israel, my Lord shall have no cause of grief or pangs of conscience for having shed blood without cause or for having saved himself. And when the Lord has dealt well with my Lord, then remember your servant. David said to Abigail, blessed be the Lord, the God of Israel, who sent you to meet me today. Blessed be your good sense, and blessed be you, who kept me today from blood guilt and from avenging myself by my own hand. For as surely as the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, who has restrained me from hurting you, unless you had hurried and come to meet me truly by morning, there would not have been left to Nabal so much as one male. In this reading, we get sort of a miracle. David's wrath is stopped in its tracks. And it's not because of Abigail's beauty, though earlier in the text it tells us twice that she's looked quite lovely. And it's not because of her wisdom and her cleverness. And it's not even because of her social prowess, her ability to know when to listen, when to wait, when to move. It's because when Abigail comes to David, she tells him the truth about who he is and who he wants to be. And that truth includes his position in the role and work of justice in contrast to God's. She reminds David that God is the one who brings justice and the only one who decides how and when it is given. David had been clouded in his anger, righteous as it is, in his hurt, and he was not able to remember his role in God's work. Abigail reminds him of his position, his role as an influence, not just among his men, but also in Israel. And she seals the deal with a reminder that David doesn't get to make those kinds of decisions. Her humility, when she approaches David, she throws herself at his feet, is supposed to remind us of those 10 young men who were sent to Nabal, who in humility came to him to make a request. And so we see this story playing out a second time, but we don't know. David has a chance to match Nabal's behavior and to reject what is being offered. Or he has an opportunity to say yes. God intervenes, and David chooses to receive the message that Abigail brings, even if he doesn't want to hear it. Vengeance might satisfy the anger that he feels, but it would not give him the end that he was looking for. So David calls off the attack. They feast, and they go home. Abigail, the next morning, as her husband deals with the hangover, the text tells us, that she tells him what she did, the attack that she prevented, and he is struck with a heart attack. And 10 days later, Nabal dies. God got vengeance on Nabal for his greed, for his negligence. But it was not done by David's hand. What is true in David's story is true for us. For our own part, we must learn from both David and Abigail. Most of the time, we are in a place where we share David's emotions, David's situation. But we should hear Abigail's words when we are in that place. God is the one who causes justice, not you. Often, we think ourselves the exception to the rule, right? At least I do. Yes, God is the only one who can bring about true justice in the world, except, of course, for my circumstances. In which case, I'm always right in my judgments, and I can definitely give out a fair judgment without being bitter or vengeful about it. But here's the truth. God has better timing and better judgment than we do. And most crucially, God is the only one who can truly judge. We can be right, we can be righteous, we can be 100% correct in our judgments. And it is still not our place to serve as judge. God, who knows the human heart, is the only one permitted to make judgments. The problem, of course, is that our judgments are often close to correct. That's why we convince ourselves that we're allowed to make these kinds of decisions. But only God can truly judge with righteousness. So maybe you don't spend your time plotting murder on the weekends, though perhaps some of you do. But none of us are free from this spirit that is in David in this moment. The desire for revenge might be for you, might be for somebody else, might even be for a whole community. So what can we do in our life to notice that desire, that impulse? And how can we move to trust God rather than tie on our swords? One way we might try to enact revenge in our worlds is through our negative assumptions about those who have brought harm. We make uncharitable remarks in our minds, with our mouths. The triggered negative assumption is an attempt at revenge, right? We have been visited harm upon, and we want to return harm on somebody else. And in this desire, sometimes we're not active participants, but just complicit. We overhear someone speaking critically or unfairly about somebody we don't like who's hurt us. And we justify it at times, saying that the people who harmed us deserve way worse than some unfair remarks and rumors, right? But when we act or fail to resist these uncharitable assumptions, we seek revenge when it is not our place to do so. We might find ourselves seeking vengeance by withholding from other people. We might not physically keep food from them or kick them out of their homes. But we might ice them out socially. We might post pointed comments on Facebook. We might intentionally change the conversation when they're close by to leave them out of the topic. We might not return or accept their apologies or their affection because we feel like they're not sorry enough. These are less obvious ways we seek revenge, but they are just as inappropriate for those who believe. The last way I see us seeking revenge is a more David-style method. We decide, just like David did, that our cause is right, that our intention is righteous. And so in arrogance, in pride, we act against those who have done harm. We might take up swords by getting into arguments with people to prove our superiority on matter. We might speak or wish ill for other people. We might allow the bitterness of the injustice to become a festering injury, a deep-seated sickness, and we might even seek out others to contaminate with that same bitterness. All of these are methods of vengeance, and we make ourselves into fools, into Nabals, just like him, when we think that this is going to soothe our hurt. We think that revenge will solve the problem. We think that vengeance will resolve the unjustness in the world. Trusting God's retribution means believing a world we can't see, a world we often don't get to see. This is remembering that it is not our job or our role to bring about full justice, like masked vigilantes running around doling out beatings like it's a weekend event. However, as we consider what it means to trust God, to be just, to judge rightly, we also get the chance, as Abigail did, to act in small ways to bring justice to the world. Abigail demonstrates her understanding of the unfairness of the situation because she meets the needs of David's men. She sends the gifts. She resolves that injustice. But she also reminds David of what he believes to be true, of what they share in belief, that it is not their job to take up arms against Nabal. God's promise of vengeance should not lead us to inaction. It should not lead us to reaction. It should only lead us to right action, which has to come from within us to others by acts of compassion, acts of love, acts of mercy, repentance. These right actions are identified by their result, not their intention. And they are acts of restoration, not of destruction. So as we reflect this week on our impulses, our areas of anger where we want to seek revenge, may we follow Abigail's example of righteous action and trust God, as they both did, to bring about true justice at just.
You've been listening to me, Pastor Kana Moore, at Hayes Christian Church. Hayes Christian Church is a non-denominational fellowship in Hayes, Kansas. We are supported by the generosity of our members, attenders, and friends. The financial support we raise goes to projects which further spread the gospel to those who do not yet know Jesus, to those local, national, and international missions, and they help keep these podcasts free. If you would like to share a monetary gift with us, please visit our website at hayeschristianchurch.org and click on the donate button, or you may mail your gift to P.O. Box 1111, Hayes, Kansas 67601. If you have any questions, comments, or would like more information, we would love to hear from you. Simply go to our website and click on the Contact Us form. Thank you for your generosity, and may God bless you as you seek to follow Him.